In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Following the First World War, there was an unprecedented need to identify and commemorate the war dead on a scale that had never been seen before. A new book by Robert Sackville West tells the story of those who dedicated their lives to searching for fallen soldiers and providing some form of closure for the bereaved. He joined us recently to talk about how the search still isn't over and how the nature of commemoration has changed over the last century. Putting the questions to him was our digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
Well, thank you so much, Robert, for joining us on the History Extra podcast. And I hope to start by hearing a little from you on who are the searchers in the title of your book.
Well, at the end of the First World War, there were about 500,000 soldiers who were mostly presumed dead. But there was no body and no grave. And as a result of that, their families hoped against hope that they were alive somewhere. And wherever there was room for doubt, they would cling to those hopes. And so in the most general sense, the searchers are all those particularly bereaved relatives who were looking for their lost dead. So that's the general category of searchers. Then there are very specific searchers from the army exhumation squads who scoured the battlefield searching for bodies to retrieve them. And there are the bereaved relatives actually going out to the battlefields to search for graves and so on. But the book begins, and the First World War begins, with a very specific type of searcher. And at the start of my book, I talk about the volunteers who worked for the now forgotten Red Cross Wounded and Missing Inquiry Department. And their 1,200 volunteer searchers, it was their job to interview wounded soldiers in hospitals and convalescent homes on their return to the UK to find out what had happened to their missing comrades. Had they actually seen them die? Could they have been taken prisoner of war? Any information to resolve the question marks about the missing. And as a result, they could then relay those findings, if possible, to the bereaved families to allay this terrible uncertainty that they were experiencing.
Right. And before we hear a little more from you on the organisations and the individuals themselves who are taking on this work, I wonder if we could hear a little more on the nature of the First World War, the scale that led to this searching being so necessary. How had identification and therefore commemoration evolved from previous conflicts?
100 years before the First World War, at the Battle of Waterloo, for example, the bodies of officers might be, or the bodies of dead officers might be brought back home and possibly on the site of the battlefield in Belgium or wherever, a monument erected to the commanding officers. But that was no longer at all appropriate at the beginning of the First World War, because at the beginning of the First World War, the British Army consisted of about 300,000 regular soldiers at the beginning of the war. During the course of the First World War, 5 million soldiers were deployed, you know, on the Western Front alone at some period of time. And many of those were killed. So it was these were citizen soldiers. They, at the beginning of the war, millions had volunteered. And even when conscription was introduced, there was a general belief that these were citizen soldiers fighting in a patriotic cause. And it was no good any longer to assume that this, you know, death on a foreign battlefield was, you know, part of the sort of necessary end for a soldier. Families, and indeed the soldiers themselves, expected that they would in some way or other be identified and commemorated in their death. And so other forms of commemoration, of burial and of ceremony had to be invented.
Right, and I understand we're going to talk a little more about those in a short while. But if we can return then to the formation of some of these organisations who took up this searching on behalf of the bereaved, what can you tell us about the efforts there?
Well, it's hard to imagine now, but at the beginning of the First World War, if you were quite wealthy and well-connected, you could go off to the battlefields of France and Belgium and actually look for or ask people yourself and soldiers yourself about what might have happened to your lost relative. You might be able to try and search for a grave. You might even visit the hospitals where wounded soldiers were. And if a number of well-heeled people did this, Rudyard Kipling did this in 1915, after his son had been killed. But actually earlier than that, a year before, a woman called Violet Cecil lost her son, George, in the first weeks of the war. And so Violet Cecil goes out with her brother-in-law, George's uncle, to the battlefields, to Villers-Cotterêts in France, to ask questions about and search for her son's, George's, grave. Robert Cecil, George's uncle, eventually finds, witnesses the unearthing of George's body in a mass grave, and is able to let Violet know and sends her some buttons from his uniform. Robert Cecil is in France because he is in charge of running ambulance services for the Red Cross. And the more he does this, the more he realizes that there is a pressing need to find out and relay and collate information about the missing. And so he sets up this organization, staffed by volunteers, called the Red Cross Wounded and Missing Inquiry Department. Over the course of the war, the volunteers of this department interview 5 million soldiers about their missing comrades and reply and answer the queries of 400,000 families. Most of those families, overwhelmingly those families are the families of privates and non-commissioned officers. So actually what you've got from the beginning of the war, you have a few well-heeled, well-connected people searching for their loved ones. By the end of the war, there is a much more democratic effort to, and obligation, it is felt, to search for, try and provide answers. Usually the answer is simply to confirm that, yes, they were dead. Occasionally, they actually find somebody in a prisoner of war camp or in a hospital. But I think the families, whatever the news, were grateful simply for the certainty that came with knowing for certain that their son, for example, was dead, and got some consolation from the fact that at least somebody, some organisation, had made inquiries on their behalf and, you know, taken that care. Because the War Office didn't have the time to or the resources to.
Right, and there's such poignancy in so many of the accounts in your book that share how families did find out about their loved one. And I thought something that was really interesting to me was the buffer that this organisation served between that brutal reality of war that led to so many of these soldiers being missing or unconfirmed, and then what the families were expecting. Could you talk a little more about that language, that role that the searchers served?
If it had been left to the War Office, what you got as a, certainly at the beginning of the war, if you were the family of an officer, you get a telegram saying your relation, whatever, had been reported missing or was dead or whatever. If you were a private, your family would simply get a letter, which would arrive several weeks later. But the statements would be very, very bald, you know, reported missing or, unfortunately, reported confirmed dead. What the Wounded and Missing Inquiry Department did was, whatever the circumstances, it provided more detail. So there would be some information, if possible, from comrades wrapped up in the confirmation of a death about the last moments of that person's death, where they were, what they said, what type of person they'd been. And so the families felt, to a certain extent, that they were sort of following in the final footsteps of their loved one, and that brought them closer to the lost one. You know, it confirmed the death, which was a necessary thing, because actually confirmation, the reality of death, was better than the limbo of uncertainty. But also it provided personal information about the loved one. And this was crucially important at a time when these men were dying, you know, hundreds of miles away. And there was no opportunity to actually, you know, say any goodbyes, no opportunity to attend a funeral, no coffin, no body. And so this personal contact that the department and its searchers provided actually gave some families at least a great consolation. It was referred to by Lord Northcliffe, who wrote a book on the Red Cross and aspects, as a labour of love. And to a certain extent, it was.
Yes, a very moving and poignant service indeed. But as you've already alluded to, complicating this picture, there were stories of bodies being misidentified, weren't there, that did offer glimmers of hope for families and loved ones?
There were. And whenever there was such a story, people would cling on to it because they would believe that that was actually possibly what had happened to them. And it was desperate, really, the extent to which people kept believing. You know, Rudyard Kipling, for example, hoped against hope that his son John had survived And he went to great extents. He contacted, you know, members of the royal family, members of European royal families in neutral countries, ambassadors to neutral countries, in the hope that they might be able to provide more information on prisoner of war lists and so on. He also organized for Air Force, or the early Air Force, to drop sort of leaflets over behind enemy lines asking for any information about his son John's whereabouts. And despite all the mounting evidence that John was dead, it wasn't till 4 years later, 1919, that he finally accepted that John was dead. He then actually spent the next almost 20 years of his life trying to find John's grave. So on the whole, the stories were, you know, missing actually meant killed. But nevertheless, people would really clutch at any straw to believe that they were alive.
Yes. So many of these stories led to an evolution in the way that the war dead and missing were commemorated. Could we talk a little about the new ceremonies that came about to memorialise and commemorate in the wake of the First World War?
I mean, the two ceremonies, I guess, that are, you know, fundamental to this, to the post-war commemoration, and actually continue to this day in really very much the same form, are the tomb of the unknown warrior and the cenotaph. And both of them were, in some ways, attempts to allow, you know, the communities to mourn the absent dead. The unknown warrior was the sort of brainchild of an army chaplain called David Railton, who one evening near his billet in Armentières in France saw at the bottom of his garden, where they were billeted, a plain wooden cross with the words written in black lead pencil, unknown soldier of the Black Watch. And he began to wonder, David Railton, the army chaplain, who was this unknown soldier? Who were his folk? What were they thinking? And slowly it dawned upon him that actually, if there could be a celebration of the unknown soldier who could represent all unknown soldiers, this would be a very reassuring thing for the bereaved. So throughout the war and just after, he kept championing his idea until it was accepted. And in 1920, the body of an unknown soldier, a completely anonymous unknown soldier, was brought back from the battlefields to Westminster Abbey. And the extraordinary thing about this was that, again, going back to this notion of how death is somehow democratized, here was an unknown common soldier. The coffin had on it the army webbing belt, the steel helmet, a sidearm. These were the equipment of, you know, the common soldier. And here was the common soldier, an anonymous common soldier, being buried in Westminster Abbey with all the pomp and ceremony which would normally be sort of accorded to a field marshal. And people absolutely related to this. They really believed that actually this, the body in this coffin, was their son. People would say, you know, it's him, it's him. Mothers in the crowd would say, my boy's come home. So this was a sort of genius idea. And then parallel to that, a slightly different idea, which fulfilled, I guess, a similar function, in some ways, was the cenotaph. And the cenotaph, which was designed by, initially in a terrible rush by Edwin Lutyens, was a much more sort of abstract, modern structure. And it wasn't Christian in sort of iconography. It was, its only words that it bore were the glorious dead. And on top there is a sort of empty, the cenotaph means empty tomb. So here was an empty as opposed to a full tomb on which the sort of blank screen on which the sort of nation could sort of project their emotions. So both of these, the cenotaph was in fact, its first iteration was in 1919, but it was so popular, it captured such a sort of public mood that it was turned into it became a permanent structure in 1920 and was unveiled on the same day as the unknown warrior was buried. And both of these structures allowed the nation to attend in some way the funeral and to mourn the body that they had never been able to do because of the war being fought at such a distance.
Yes, it's so interesting how these two memorials came to serve such different purposes. I found that really, really interesting to read about. And if we can return to the searches themselves and the service they were providing for families or seeking for themselves, can we talk a little more about the sense of therapy or closure or catharsis, whatever might be the right word in situations, that people found in these efforts?
The individuals, the bereaved relatives, they found, well, as I was saying, with the tomb of the unknown warrior, you know, my boy has come home. That was what, or when they got a letter from the Wounded and Missing Inquiry Department, which gave them some personal information, along with the fact that their loved one was dead. This gave them, you know, sort of confirmation and, you know, I guess in today's parlance, some sort of closure or acceptance of the reality. One of the major things that people did after the war, you know, you think now that it's only a sort of battlefield tourism is something that we do in the 20th and our school children do in the 20th century. But actually, immediately after the war, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, of Britons, went to the battlefields of the Western Front, literally on pilgrimage. And what they wanted to see, well, they wanted to see a grave because it was their first opportunity to see a grave. And so the way that they, these visitors to the cemeteries that they were visiting, write about these graves are again, at last, my eye can rest easy because I have seen where my John or whoever lies. And they would take tracings from the headstones, or they would then take away a little piece of moss from the grave, or even if there was barbed wire, a little piece of barbed wire from there. They would take some memento and they would pray and they would leave flowers. And I think that it was that at last they could visit all those that had relatives who had known graves, could visit that grave. And I think that was what brought, and certainly in the literature of the time, brought great solace to those searchers. And it was a tribute to the War Graves Commission, who had constructed these, what were initially rather controversial cemeteries, but constructed them in such a way that there was a sort of a great beauty to the places that these pilgrims visited.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Even today, 50 bodies are found in the battlefields of France and Belgium every year. That's all 50 sets of human remains. And again, each of these is then, every effort is made to identify, name and honour.
And for those who couldn't make such a pilgrimage, you write about those who sort of, there are mantelpieces across the country that sort of become shrines to those who are missing, who are fallen. What about those who couldn't make such a journey? Could they, was the same sort of, I'll use that word again, closure available to people?
Well, they could always visit, well, if you could travel to London, you could visit, and even pilgrimage were made to the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior and to the Cenotaph. So you could do that. But actually, in parallel to the cemeteries that were being constructed in on the Western Front in the 1920s, there were tens of thousands of war memorials being constructed in Britain. It was an absolute sort of boom time for stone monumental masons. And so in parish churches, in village squares, in workplaces, there were sometimes memorials, sometimes lists of names, often much more idiosyncratic, I guess, and individual than the uniform. The genius of the cemeteries was their uniformity, their statement that there is equality in death, and they were uniform. But in the UK, people could do what they wanted. So you could still either go to London on pilgrimage or celebrate, or not celebrate, participate in Remembrance Day services, or you could visit your local church. And one of the things that did happen, as the cemeteries were being built and replacing the often wooden crosses that had previously marked those graves, the wooden crosses were often brought back to Britain, and many parish churches around the country have in their porch or wherever a collection of these wooden, original wooden crosses commemorating the initial resting places of their former villagers.
So you've spoken about the efforts to identify and commemorate in the immediate aftermath of the First World War and into the 1920s. But such an interesting factor in your book that it's explored is that the search isn't over, is it?
No, it's not. And that is perhaps one of the things that surprised me most. Because obviously, in theory, it shouldn't come as a surprise, because even at the time, 3 million British people lost a very close, an immediate family member, a child, a spouse, a sibling, a son. That's 3 million people really closely affected. And the other thing is now, this impact still ripples on in British society. Almost everyone of British descent has an ancestor who served in the armed forces in the First World War. Most of those would have served on the Western Front, and many would have been killed. So there is a direct connection. I know it's over two or three generations now, maybe more, but with the First World War. So there is an interest in what happened to these ancestors. And an example of the sort of level of interest is that the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, which manages or creates and manages the cemeteries, in the 1970s, received a couple of thousand inquiries a year about, you know, the location of graves and so on and so forth. They now, its website now receives 5,000 visits a day. You know, that's over a million visits a day. People trying to find out where so-and-so, some great-great uncle, great-grandfather is buried. So there's an interest from people in this subject. And that interest is continues to be served, it seems to me, by the Commonwealth War Graves, in that they continue to attempt to identify, retrieve, identify, name and honour people as they did 100 years ago. So in 2009, work started on the, you know, the biggest archaeological project to do with the First World War that there has ever been. And at a place called Fromelles in France, 250 English and Australian soldiers' bodies were unearthed, well, discovered and unearthed in mass graves, and attempts were made to identify these 250 soldiers, which is an incredibly difficult process after the elapse of 100 years. But due to, you know, modern forensic techniques and DNA sampling and so on, they managed to actually name 166, or so far 166, of these 250 bodies. And these bodies have been buried, and many of them were buried in the company of their descendants who attended these burials. So that search goes on. Even today, 50 bodies are found in the battlefields of France and Belgium every year. That's all 50 sets of human remains. And again, each of these is then, every effort is made to identify name and honour. So, I mean, as part of the research for the book, I visited the mortuary near Arras, where the Commonwealth War Graves Commission does this work. And as, you know, an industrial state is developed, or a new hospital is created, or a canal dug, these bodies continue to surface at the rate of, you know, 50 a year. And they really do make the effort to identify them. And then, often through DNA sampling, and their families then are invited to attend the burial 100 years later, or more than 100 years later. So that happens. The other thing that happens is that every year there are probably about a dozen services of rededication, where a grave that was previously inscribed as the grave of an unknown British soldier, new evidence comes to light, which allows researchers to identify that grave as belonging to an actually named individual, as they've worked out how it must be so-and-so. And there are probably about a dozen or so of those ceremonies every year. And I've spoken to various people who have been, you know, contacted and then attended services of great uncles and so on. And even though it's obviously nothing like as sort of visceral the experience as it would have been for a grieving widow in the 1920s, there is still a sense that it, for some of these families, fills some void in the family history, you know, that you know where that person in that photograph in your family album, where in fact, you know, for the first time you learn where they actually are buried.
Yes, indeed. And I wonder if you could talk a little about Kipling's efforts, because it wasn't till the 90s that his son was finally identified. Is that right?
Yes, so exactly. So he was an example of, as it were, a rededication. And John Kipling was killed in September 1915. And as I said, his parents, you know, spent 4 years hoping that he was still alive. And then even after they'd accepted his death, then spent, you know, the whole of the 1920s, they went on annual pilgrimages to France, hoping that one day they'd get some information about where his grave might be. And they never did. And the Kiplings died in the late 1930s, not knowing where John lay. And so I suppose for them, the only consolation was Kipling had been literary advisor to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission and had come up with all the phrases associated with Commonwealth War Graves Commission. So whenever you see "their name liveth forevermore," this was a phrase that Kipling had taken, in fact, from Ecclesiasticus. But, you know, he'd, you know, decided that this was a, you know, really the phrase that we should, you know, come to associate with these cemeteries. And so it was an irony in a way that his, John's name, well, it lived on a memorial to the missing, but not as a grave. And it was only in 1992 that, quite controversially, a researcher from the associated with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission came up with the conclusion that a particular grave in a cemetery near Ypres, which was described as a grave of an unknown Irish lieutenant, which is what John Kipling was, that it was accepted that that grave must belong to John Kipling. So, you know, this was 60 years after, or almost 60 years after the Kiplings had died, that eventually the, you know, the name was actually ascribed to a particular grave. But it was a terrible, you know, the loss. I think what happened with the First World War is that, you know, the deaths of all these young men reversed the natural order of death. In, you know, you would expect the parents to die first, but actually in this instance it was the sons that were dying first, and this was incredibly disorienting. And, you know, the Kipling, Rudyard Kipling, his wife, were disoriented by John's death for the rest of their lives. And whereas they went to France to look for John's grave, you know, his contemporary, he had a contemporary called Raymond Lodge, who, you know, turned to the spirit world to contact his son. So these were the lengths to which people would go.
Yes, it's an incredibly moving story, and there are so many in your account. And I wonder if we could perhaps begin to wrap up by touching on what you do in the book, and mention that it's 100 years since the poppy was adopted as a symbol of commemoration and remembrance. And also the 2 minutes silence. How has it evolved in terms of a tool of introspection and remembrance?
I don't know whether it's the actual silence has evolved as a sort of tool of introspection, but it's certainly the tone of the day has evolved. And one of the interesting aspects is that in 1920, when the cenotaph was unveiled, there was very little. The Prime Minister was very insistent that it should be a sort of secular day. Shouldn't be too religious. There wouldn't be prayers at that particular unveiling. And I think that throughout time, according to the sort of mood of the nation, the service becomes either more or less religious, more or less pacifist. You know, in the 1930s, as the Second World War approached, and, you know, there were movements for, you know, the pacifism was strong. There were, you know, movements even to, it was thought that, you know, Remembrance Day had its day. And in any case, it should be more geared towards celebrating international peace rather than any form of commemoration of war. I think things change massively over time. In the 1970s, I remember Remembrance Day not being that big a thing. Today, it is probably as emotive a ritual as exists. So the rituals and people's perception of them, I think, change. And the one thing that doesn't change, though, and if this is the genius of the silence, is that if you, whoever you are, and whatever you may think about war and peace, a secular remembrance or a religious remembrance, whatever you think about what defines Britishness or what doesn't, at least the silence is that opportunity when people can simply be, as you say, introspective and think about all these things and possibly think about ancestors they may have had who'd fought. And I think that that is its real strength.
That was Robert Sackville-West. His book, The Searchers, The Quest for the Lost of the First World War, is published by Bloomsbury and is out now. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us again tomorrow when David Kennedy will be answering your questions on the Great Depression.